The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to take an in-depth look at several issues that are not being covered at all in the mainstream or alternative media, left or right. Our original in-depth investigative report from our office with Richard Gale, myself, Death by Vaccination, the Gates Foundation and the New Eugenics Movement. This is currently being posted on Progressive Radio Network and GaryKnoll.com. So that you can look at it carefully. It is fully footnoted and referenced. That will come in a few moments. My guest in the second half of today's program is Eric Weiner. We're going to talk about the shadow market, a different kind of financial power among the wealthy global elite that manipulates the economies of the world. And in relationship to that, I'll be sharing some insights about manufacturing dissent. I'm sure you've heard that concept used. It was originally coined by Noam Chomsky, but today it's Professor Michael Chavdovsky who is going to talk about how, with the New World Order and the ritual of inviting civil society leaders into the inner circles of power, while simultaneously repressing the rank and file, you and I, it serves several important functions. First, it says to the world that the critics of globalization must make concessions. We must make concessions to earn the right to mingle. And second, it conveys the illusion that while the global elite should, under what is euphemistically called democracy, be subject to criticism, they nonetheless rule legitimately. And third, it says there is no alternative to globalization. Fundamental change is not possible, and the most we can hope to engage with these rulers in an effective give and take. Give on our part, take on theirs. And that's one of the reasons why so many liberals and Democrats have compromised the basic virtue of authentic change and standing firm on principles of integrity and what is right. We have seen it with Kennedy, Carter, Clinton, and now Obama. And yet, time and again, when you speak with those on the left, from which I come, from which I have evolved, I see that they'll say, but you must make compromises. You can't do it with a purist mindset. Nothing will get done. And I disagree. And I'll show you today how the people who are the real elites, those who really are at the business roundtable and the Council on Foreign Relations, how they bring into their circle those who might have started off with more idealistic notions, might have really believed that we can have a world where both needs are met, those of the super powerful and those of the rank and file. No, they can't. But I'll show you how we get to where we believe that the only options we have are constant compromise. Bail out the banks, but not the main public. Give them unlimited amounts of money. Take away all their bad debt and wash it, clean it up. Get rid of those toxic assets under TARP. But don't save a single person from being foreclosed on. That's the consequences of that mindset. The Al Gore mindset. The John Kerry mindset and the people who supported that because they believed that the Democrats had the right answer, the liberals had the right answer. No, they didn't. But how are people seduced? How do they give away the power that they were expected to use? Why is it that when the American public voted in the Democrats in power, it was to get us out of the war? How those people they voted us in actually took us into more war? How does this happen? Today, you'll see how. Let us begin our program with the latest on health and healing. And this is even a challenge to the editors of Scientific America. They say that the FDA should hold foods to the same, quote, standards of science as those of drugs, unquote. This is from NUUSA. This proves that even the smartest people can sometimes reach conclusions completely lacking in common sense. For those of you who are not aware of it, right now throughout the world there's a major battle going on. Those who have historically have wanted the right to use homeopathy or herbs or supplements or diet for both prevention and treatment of conditions, and those who believe that there should only be one way, genetically engineered foods and pharmaceutical drugs. No competition whatsoever. Time and again, we have prevailed. But each time they come back, and each time they enlist more lobbyists, more think tanks, more scientists for hire, more legislators now on their side, and they've managed to make great gains on their side. The average person doesn't hear about this, isn't made aware of it, except in media such as this. You don't hear this anywhere on liberal radio. Nowhere. To the contrary, liberal radio, including Democracy Now!, actually promoted the idea that the FDA should have more power and should be supporting Senate Bill, Food Safety Bill 510, which would virtually eliminate all organic and sustainable farmers in America, 100%. There wouldn't be one in America 2 years after that's enacted. Why can't they see this? It's part of their conditioning. It's part of what comes when you're a purist ideologue on the left, as it is on the right. So now there is an effort underway to take away our right to have supplements. And they've already done this in Europe. It's passed. It's no longer up for debate. It's the law. Come April 1st of next year, you won't be able to buy a single herb, medicinal herb, anywhere in the European Union. So after all those battles and codex, they won. So now here's Scientific America saying, yeah, hold vitamins to the same standards of scientific accountability as you would a drug. Big Pharma's line that food and supplements should be treated like drugs is often quoted by policymakers and analysts. What they don't realize is that it both defies logic and tramples free speech about science. It also supports the drug company's monopoly. Scientific American is a justly venerable publication with a 150-year history. But in their most recent issue, an editorial entitled Snake Oil in the Supermarket states that consumers are currently getting a rotten deal with regards to functional foods. Quote, although health claims for foods may appear to be authoritative, in many cases science does not support them and the government does not endorse them, unquote. Quote, not only do these products, many of which are nutritionally bereft, fail to deliver on their promises, but they may also give consumers a false sense of security that discourages them from taking more effective measures to attain wellness, such as their medications and exercise, unquote. Here they go again. Can't Scientific American grasp that drugs are generally synthetic, new to nature, and because of the patent, it is feasible for drug companies to pay $1 billion on average to get FDA approval. Natural substances, being generally not patentable, are shut out of the system, but for that very reason are much, much cheaper. Do we want a system where we go to our doctor for a food or supplement prescription and then pay $5 per cherry or $100 for a bottle of vitamin C? This would just wipe out functional foods and supplements and give drug companies a complete and total monopoly. What would drug prices look like then? Moreover, scientific research is already being performed on supplements and functional foods the world over. It's the FDA that will not allow such scientific evidence to be cited. It gets worse. Scientific America wants the FDA to adopt the standards used by the European Food Safety Authority. That's the agency that says beta-carotene supplements shouldn't have more beta-carotene than is 1.5 carats. That's correct, 1.5 carats. The Scientific America editors offer yogurt manufacturer Danyon as an example. In the U.S., the Activia website, quote, prominently displays the product's putative health benefits, asserting that it can help regulate your digestive system by helping reduce long intestinal transit time, unquote. The version in the UK, on the other hand, says only that yogurt contains an exclusive bacterial culture and, like other yogurts, is a source of calcium vitamin B12, unquote. But if scientific journals have reviewed and published findings like those from Tufts University, that the probiotics in yogurt help control constipation, diarrhea, inflammatory bowel disease, and H. pylori infection, and may help prevent colon cancer, shouldn't a company selling yogurt be allowed to cite that evidence? Drug companies are great at propaganda. The FDA is completely corrupt. And Scientific American editors, of all people, should be able to see right through it, and they don't. Once again, the best and brightest are on the wrong side of the angels on this. It is not snake oil. Every single article that I cite is backed by clinical research, published in peer-reviewed literature, and I have hundreds of thousands of these. And each and every one is fully, fully documented. Yet they will never look at any of these. If they do so, they dismiss them out of hand, because it doesn't follow the propaganda line. So on the one hand, we have outstanding science showing that the healthy choices we make each day will benefit our body and prevent disease and help us overcome disease. But mainstream medicine is aligned with Big Pharma, and Big Pharma is aligned with proprietary science, and proprietary science is aligned with the FDA and all policymaking institutions in the United States. Hence, we have good science that supports good healthy practices and bad science supporting proprietary interest. And your doctor, with rare exception, is the propagandist of that. So we have to be aware of how our rights are being eroded. Let me just give you one example. Chronic drinking. Do you hear the FDA talking about drinking? Do you hear anyone talking about drinking? No. But Scientific America, their mainstream publication, quotes, both drinking and withdrawal from chronic drinking can raise circulating glucocorticoid levels, known as cortisol in humans and corticosterone in rodents. Prolonged and high concentrations of these can have damaging effects on neuron function and cognition. Evidence shows that the steroids are associated with neurotoxicity during abstinence after withdrawal from alcohol dependence, and that these receptor antigens may represent a pharmacological option for recovery. And this was published in Alcoholism Clinical and Experimental Research. What they're showing is when you drink, you change the cortisol level in your body. End quote. From their study, done at the Department of Pharmacological Sciences at the University of Kentucky, quote, high levels of brain cortisol associated with stress have long been linked to deficits in neuron function, which can be seen in aging. So what they're showing is just common drinking prematurely ages the brain, and there are hundreds of studies in peer-reviewed literature on that. Do they go after them? No. Do we know how to prevent this? Yes, you don't drink. But also, how can we repair the damage? There are dozens of studies showing how we can do that. That is what we should be promoting. We don't do any of it. One more example. This is from the Institute of Psychology of Nanjing University. And it says acupuncture helps prevent suicides. Whole article done, published, peer-reviewed journal, done in a major scientific institution, and reviewing 287,000 people committed suicide last year, and what the basis of helping people who were at suicidal levels who no longer felt suicidal once they had acupuncture. So we have the research. They're not going to look at any of it. They're going to dismiss all of it. There's not going to be one scientist, one physician, one scientific article. There's going to be nothing that they accept. They take a scorched earth, take no prisoners approach. Everything that is good, they're against. Everything that is bad, they're for. If you drink, you smoke, you overeat, French fries, hamburgers, hot dogs, colas, sodas, artificial soft drinks, pesticides of every kind, make synthetically derived foods, all that they support. Genetic engineering, they love it. Eating right, exercising, de-stressing, taking your supplements, then you must be a quack. Just understand, this is all about politics and money. It has nothing to do, nothing, with science. And we've yet to have a president who is healthy, mentally, spiritually, or physically. We've yet to have members of Congress who, as more than a couple, who have the same values. So that's that. Back in a moment with an in-depth, original investigative report, Death by Vaccination, Bill Gates, and how he is the new leader of the eugenics movement in the world. By Vaccination. While lecturing at the elitist TED 2010 conference in Long Beach, California, Bill Gates slipped a statement while speaking on the dangers of climate change and overpopulation. He said, quote, "Vaccines, I love them," unquote. His admission was made in the context of his philanthropic strategy, and as we will see, vaccines play a dominant role in his firm conviction that population reduction is an urgent priority for the survival of humanity. Then the question is, who should be eliminated from the population? Who is elected from the public to make such decisions? Who should live? Who should die? Who should never be born? The short answer is, no one. Hence, it is being done quietly through foundations, international agencies, and private industry. Today, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is the most powerful charity in the world and one of the most quietly influential international organizations of any sort. The foundation is funded to the tune of $34.6 billion, plus an additional $30 billion from Warren Buffett's investments. This is almost the entire budget of the World Health Organization. Gates has followed in the footsteps of the Rockefellers, and they led the Green Revolution, an aggressive onslaught of genetically modified seeds to increase large-scale corporate influence agriculture in Africa, India, and elsewhere. The international GMO initiatives have devastated small cooperative farms and have served as the lifeline of food for centuries and has resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of farmers. Of course, nobody among the oligarchical elites, such as Gates, Rockefeller, and Monsanto executives, will suffer from the consequences of their failed revolution. However, it is vaccine research and development targeting Africans primarily, but also other developing nations that hold center stage in his foundation's strategic funding. During the recent 2010 World Economic Forum, Gates announced he would spend $10 billion over the next 10 years on child vaccine development for poorer nations. While calling this admirable might appear to be an understatement, which vaccines and which channels of funding require scrutiny in order to assess the value and motives of the foundation's mission. In 2000, the Gates Foundation founded the International Finance Facility for Immunization. And that organization's Global Fund for Children's Vaccines is a global collaboration that includes governments, the Rockefeller Foundation, the World Bank, the World Health Organization, the International Federation of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers, UNICEF, and vaccine makers and other influential entities. All of these are zealot vaccine promoters. The organization's mission is to vaccinate every child in Africa. And through their organization and its various programs, an estimated 250 million children in developing countries have already been vaccinated. But the foundation itself does not perform drug and vaccine research and development. In addition to traditional grant giving, it also provides lines of credit. For example, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative received from the foundation a $100 million line of credit to empower the nonprofit organization to influence HIV vaccine development within the vaccine industrial complex. Over the past several years, evidence is accumulating over Gates and his foundation's duplicity in saying one thing and acting otherwise. For example, frequently Gates has stated his opposition to Big Tobacco and claims he refuses to invest or fund any organization and company contributing to smoking. However, a recent investigation showed that the foundation has in fact invested in Big Tobacco for quite some time. Similarly, behind his verbiage on tackling climate change and shifting to non-fossil fuel technologies at the TED conference, Gain remains a heavy investor in big oil, particularly ExxonMobil and British Petroleum, perhaps the two oil companies the most corrupt in history of this movement. We appear, therefore, to be faced with a serious uncertainty over the public image of the very likable, mild-mannered Bill Gates, who expresses repeatedly his ambition to improve the health of the developing world, and then the possibility of other ulterior motives that are contrary to saving lives. Should we take Bill Gates and his foundation's word that their primary objective is to improve the health and well-being of children in poorer nations by fighting disease and illness with vaccines? Or is his vaccine agenda another ruse with a more sinister agenda? For example, it's hard to imagine that Gates is unaware that his commitment to the Green Revolution is, in point of fact, a green disaster, and that no GMO has lived up to its promise. Yet he simply continues his enormous funding of agricultural genetic manipulation projects. Therefore, we believe there is sound reason that his foundation's many international vaccine initiatives represent much more than exclusively kind-hearted charity. Over the past several years, the prestigious British medical journal The Lancet has printed a series of in-depth analysis of the Gates Foundation with disturbing revelations. In an article titled "Misfinancing Global Health, A Case for Transparency in Disbursements and Decision-Making," the author's investigation came to the conclusion that aside from excessive funding of high-profile Western institutions and organizations, there was, quote, a heavy bias in funding towards malaria, HIV/AIDS, with relatively little investment into tuberculosis, maternal and child health, and nutrition, with chronic diseases being entirely absent from its spending portfolio, unquote. A later study by Dr. David McCoy from the Center for International Health found that, quote, the grants made by the foundation do not reflect the burden of disease endured by those in deepest poverty, unquote. None of these findings have been covered to any extent by mainstream media nor any governing body. No one can doubt Gates's intellectual genius and talent. Neither are we questioning his philanthropic endeavors that exceeds that of any other human being. So then, why is his foundation spending so much wealth unwisely, and why is it ignoring far more effective and less costly solutions and practices for relieving the suffering of millions of children, women, and men throughout the developing world? In his deconstruction of Bill Gates and its charitable agenda, F. William Indall writes, quote, vaccinating a child who then goes on to drink feces-polluted river water is hardly healthy in any respect. But, of course, cleaning up the water and sewage systems of Africa would revolutionize the health conditions of the continent. far from effective, far more effective would be the foundation donating its billions to improve sanitation and hygiene and provide nutrition to the 2.6 billion people who have none, for increasing clean water sources so 900 million global residents can have access to drinking water. Now one in three in Africans do not have that. Instead, the foundation could be funding thousands of health clinics focusing on the chronic illnesses these populations suffer from most. This is simply common sense. Bad water, says the Stockholm International Water Institute's director, Anders Bentel, quote, kills more people than HIV, malaria, and wars together. Spending billions of dollars to develop new vaccines and launch monumental efforts to vaccinate African children plagued with diverse infections promises to be a fruitless enterprise while these populations continue to live in squalor. After decades of mass vaccination programs across Africa, current vaccines have neither proven their medical effectiveness and safety nor their ability to truly enhance the quality of life of impoverished Africans. Instead, as part of its Millennium Development Goal, the foundation prefers to make its rotavirus vaccine program to battle diarrheal diseases one of its two major focuses in partnership with PATH and the World Health Organization, the CDC. The FDA has already announced warnings of rotavirus' vaccine life-threatening adverse effects, such as severe twisting of children's intestines that can lead to death. Children in developing countries already suffering from extreme immune deficiencies due to malnutrition and lack of sanitary living conditions and local diseases only have their bodies further weakened after any vaccine. As a keynote speaker at the TED Conference 2010, Gates laid out his rationale for an international effort towards global depopulation. He said, quote, if we do a really great job on new vaccines and healthcare and reproductive health services, we could lower that projected 9 billion people by perhaps 10 to 15%, unquote. New vaccines for depopulation? What Gates might be referring to by new vaccines is the creation of new generations of sterilizing or aborting vaccines with an ingredient or genetically engineered component that can go undetected. Vaccines to prevent pregnancy already exist. In fact, they've been with us for a long time. One area of vaccine research the Gates Foundation is funding in its Grand Challenges explorations is the use of nanoparticles. Such engineered vaccines with no gold standard for long-term safety and efficacy could virtually go undetected without highly advanced and expensive technologies to identify their presence. As early as 1968, the Rockefeller Foundation's annual report recommended anti-fertility vaccines as a viable means for lessening the human population growth rate that should be aggressively pursued. The quandary lies in an ethical, moral, and transparent means which honor the free choice of the individual for reducing the global birth rate. Unfortunately, past history shows that previous attempts to inoculate communities with anti-fertility vaccines have not only been unethical, but covert and criminal. And when one thinks about it, what better way to lessen population growth, in addition to reducing years of life expectancy, than through family planning vaccination programs spearheaded by government-mandated international finance and health organizations, such as the World Bank and World Health Organization, and by willing governments and billionaires who are happy to help fund eugenic efforts. In addition, there are many powerful nonprofit organizations, such as Save the Children and USAID, who benefit handsomely from these multilateral institutions and rely upon their funding to carry out their demands. An early anti-fertility trial using human hormones, this is the gonadotropin, a hormone essential for pregnancy and vaccines, was completed in 1988 in India through a Rockefeller collaboration with India's National Institutes of Immunology. The Rockefeller annual report declares success. Yet according to Betsy Hartman, director of Hampshire College's Population and Development Program, quote, although one vaccine has been tested on only 180 women in India, It is being billed as safe, devoid of any side effects, and completely reversible, unquote. Perhaps the most thorough documented investigation into the covert use of anti-fertility vaccines is a 1995 report, Are New Vaccines Laced with Birth Control Drugs?, compiled by J.I. Miller, a correspondent for the pro-life missionary movement Human Life International. In the early 1990s, the World Health Organization, supported by the Rockefeller Foundation, the World Bank, and the UN Development Program, and the U.S. National Institute of Health, undertook stealth anti-fertility initiatives under the disguise of tetanus vaccination programs. These vaccines were administered to unsuspecting and poor communities in Mexico, Nicaragua, and the Philippines. The tetanus vaccines, manufactured by Conant and Intervex in Canada and CSL Limited in Australia, a leading maker of the H1N1 flu vaccine that has been implicated in statistically significant numbers of seizures and heavily supported by the Rupert Murdoch family, were laced with HCG, same hormone. Scientists working on the project discovered that the tetanus vaccine was an ideal vehicle for introducing the HCG peptides that, when injected into a woman's body, would induce ICG antibodies, thereby preventing pregnancy. In brief, a woman's body turns on autopilot to attack her own natural production of HCG. All would have gone well for the scheme's masterminds if it were not for individuals working in local religious charities having observed some highly suspicious procedures. For example, why were only women between the ages of 15 to 45 receiving the tetanus shot and no men? And why were multiple booster shots required during the following months when a single tetanus injection is well known to provide protection for 10 years? In the Philippines, laboratory results of vaccinated women in almost all cases discovered the presence of HCG antibodies. Lab investigations into the vaccines uncovered the presence of HCG, and a subsequent investigation found that none of the HCG-laced vaccine lots had been registered with the government's Bureau of Food and Drugs. The episode was entirely a black op, superhuman stealth experiment preying upon poor innocent women. And while that is just one of the best documented examples, other less well-known eugenic experiments during the 1990s using anti-fertility vaccines have been conducted in Haiti and among the Akha people in Thailand, in poor African-American neighborhoods in Los Angeles, and among indigenous people in the northern and southern latitudes. A 1995 BBC documentary, The Human Laboratory, interviewed Filipino women activist Mary Pilar Verzonas, who reported on the vaccine's adverse effects. These included fertility cycles that were, quote, all fouled up, spontaneous bleeding, miscarriages. Seemingly, women were not screened to determine whether or not they were pregnant before injections. Consequently, in addition to interfering with a woman's ability to become pregnant, the World Health Organization was launching a clandestine experiment to observe whether the vaccine could trigger miscarriages. And again, none of this was discussed at all. Now, in addition, no published studies exist for long-term follow-up on women receiving HCG-laced vaccines and associated severe adverse effects. Given the World Health Organization's past record of seriously flawed misjudgments and secrecy, the recent fabrication of a level 6 H1N1 pandemic being an excellent recent example, and those of other organizations complicit in covert vaccine operations, we should not be surprised that such studies exist, because the HCG hormone is involved in many other bodily functions besides pregnancy. It is likely that artificially creating HCG antibodies in a woman would result in a cascade of serious, some possibly incurable health problems. The hormone plays an important role in endocrine functioning of the brain's hypothalamus. It is known diagnostic marker for certain types of tumors. Artificially interfering in its production would potentially cause any number of different cancers. And since HCG is essential for healthy pituitary gland functioning, such toxic vaccines would interfere with this master gland's regulatory function of maintaining homeostatic balance, hormonal equilibrium throughout the body's endocrine system, and there can be an incalculable number of adverse conditions resulting from such a vaccine. If used with the wrong motives, vaccines can be devices for lessening lifespan. In addition, there are unanswered questions about how safe and effective vaccines actually are. For example, a child will not develop cancer or acquire chronic autoimmune dysfunction a week or two after receiving a flu or measles injection. Yet vaccines, especially those relying upon animal tissue to culture viruses during the manufacturing process, the influenza, the MMR, and the yellow fever vaccine are known to be highly contaminated with foreign animal viruses, including avian leucosis virus, equine aristis virus, and genetic fragments from such viruses. Oncogenes, which are genes that can turn normal cells cancerous, and prions, tiny proteins responsible for incurable diseases, neurological disorders in animals and humans. Public awareness of this fact appeared in transcripts from private meetings of the Center for Disease Control's Vaccine and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee and the Evolving Scientific and Regulatory Perspective Workshops, respectively, and obtained by British investigative journalist Janine Roberts. Now, according to the committee participants, representing, quote, the largest public health institutions in the West, it is impossible to remove DNA contaminants from vaccines. When the question was raised whether or not vaccine DNA contamination could cause cancer or autoimmune disease, one of the respondents to the meeting stated, quote, when you consider that almost every one of these vaccines is injected right into the tissue, I think you couldn't do much more to get DNA expressed, meaning contaminated cancer-causing DNA taken up by the human cells, than to inject it into a muscle in the way it is being done, unquote. Dr. Wolfgang Woodarg, chairman of the Health Committee in Germany's Parliament and the European Council, reported that Novartis was using, quote, a nutrient solution relying on cancer cell lines in a bioreactic way to manufacture H1N1 vaccine. He issued warnings that adverse reactions to this kind of engineered vaccine are unknown. Bill Gates' mission to protect poor populations from disease through mass vaccination, his sense of urgency that the global population is too large and needs to be reduced, and his deep financial and collaborative enterprises with the oligarchical elite and health agencies and multilateral organizations with a past history of eugenic intentions and experimentation make for a bizarre mix that raises serious questions about the truth behind his foundation's motives. America has a long history of eugenic science through the first half of the 20th century. John D. Rockefeller, Margaret Sanger, Paul Popenoe, Madison Grant, and others. The names of the organizations and facilities they founded or supported tell the story. Andrew Carnegie's Institute was the primary funder of the Eugenics Record Office that opened from the Cold Springs Harbor Laboratories. The laboratories were closed in 1944 after a public became aware of thousands of sterilizations it oversaw. Likewise, the Rockefellers were major funders of not only Cold Spring Harbor, but also the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute of Eugenics, which became the center of the Nazis' extermination experiments. The Rockefeller's Population Council, with the mission to advance birth control, was first headed by Frederick Osborne, a leader in the American Eugenics Society. And there's no reason to believe America's eugenic tradition has died out, although it has mutated into what might appear to be a less malignant form compared to the days when over half of the 50 states were conducting forced sterilization on poor women and inmates in prisons and mental institutions. Nobody should doubt the eugenic agenda remains alive and well in America. In fact, behind the closed corridors among the global elite, it is gaining fuel. For these people, sacrificing poor people in the developing world on the altar of distorted manifest destiny and setting their own rules in modern technologies, vaccines and GMO seeds, with the potential to destroy every unborn child is simply racism and bigotry. Kenyon College anthropologist Dr. Ken Smell, in a World Health Watch article, wrote, quote, that there will be a large-scale reduction in global human numbers over the next 2 to 3 centuries appears to be inevitable. The primary issue seems to be whether this process will be under conscious human control and hopefully relatively benign, or whether it will turn out to be unpredictably chaotic and perhaps catastrophic, unquote. The weakness in today's elite population of believing that they are the only ones with the right to depopulate is fourfold. First, it has always been the poorest, less educated segments of humanity that should be reduced to no one else, in their mind. Therefore, second, since they cannot be allowed to have freedom of choice or vote on the matter, the elites must make that decision for them, because they are the best and the brightest. Third, their argument crumbles, since it is the elites themselves that place value on one particular life as being different than another. And finally, since depopulation cannot be executed transparently, it must be done through deceit and clandestine means. In conclusion, so what are the lessons to be learned from this? The wealthiest elite on the planet are rarely questioned about the correctness of their actions and schemes. As long as one of these individuals say they are giving huge sums of money to a cause, to end disease and suffering, we are not supposed to probe further. Rather, in the case of mainstream media, such people are to be worshipped as saviors. The oligarchical elite, as well as interconnected on multiple boards of directors, clubs for the rich and powerful, think tanks, and among the high ranks of elected legislators and politicians, well, that is difficult to have an open and honest debate on the merits of their actions and spending. When a Ted Turner says we should reduce the world's population by more than half, and Bill Gates suggests 15% reduction, do we really understand they are following a form of eugenic genocide? I'm Gary Knoll, and that original in-depth investigative report by Richard Gale, scholar in residence, myself, is posted. In a moment, my guest, please stay with us. Our guest standing by is Eric Weiner. He has covered business and economic issues for 15 years as a writer and editor. He is a former columnist and reporter for Dow Jones Newswires, and he's written for the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, the Village Voice, and countless other major publications. He is also a contributor to the news and opinion website, the Huffington Post, and his most recent book just released is a true eye-opener, The Shadow Market: How a Group of Wealthy Nations and Powerful Investors Secretly Dominate the World. Nice to have you with us today, Eric.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Eric, I am just going to ask you a series of questions and just let you roll with it, all right?
Fair enough.
What is the shadow market? I'm going to ask you several.
Okay.
And who are the main players? And how is the shadow market a different use? How do they use power differently than the normal kind of wealth and power we associate with Wall Street and their lobbyists? And finally, what are the consequences, and who suffers, and why haven't we known about any of this? The forum is yours.
You basically asked all the questions in my book. That's very good. There are a couple more covered, but yeah. The shadow market, to start off, is not what you would consider a normal market, in the sense that it doesn't have an address like Wall Street or a building like, you know, the New York Stock Exchange or an index to track, you know, S&P 500 or what have you. It's really a invisible nexus where capital and money is transferred into geopolitical power. And it's not something that hasn't existed before. It just has never existed in this form. For the longest time, specifically post-World War II, America was the shadow market. Our institutions, our government, our banks provided this, the money that is provided by the shadow market. So when you're talking about the shadow market, you're really talking about the concept of liquidity. You're familiar, the idea being that, keeping the markets flowing, keeping capital flowing through the markets, confers on the group that does that a tremendous amount of power eventually. So this has been gradually happening, but it really ramped up around 2008, where the major players, as you pointed, term them, really started asserting themselves, largely because they recognized, because of our behavior, that they were really, really rich, as opposed to just being sort of rich. They were really, really rich. And we're talking about Asian nations like China and Singapore. We're talking about Middle Eastern Persian Gulf oil states, particularly really small ones. In the UAE, you have Abu Dhabi, Dubai to a lesser extent. Qatar is very big in this. You have Kuwait. You have Saudi Arabia. But you also have countries like Norway, which has a tremendous amount of oil wealth and is able to do things in Europe that other countries are not. And you're starting to see the other blossoming economies step in, and that's, you know, India and Brazil, obviously the large guys, and then Korea, and to a lesser extent South Africa and Australia. And they have, for various reasons, usually either access to wealthy markets or through their own natural resources, have basically been able to gather accumulate a tremendous amount of wealth. And what's different about this is that when we were doing it, we're still a part of this, but when we controlled it, much of it was controlled by our corporations, our institutions, our pension funds and things like that, which have separate goals than a government. They're much more predictable. You can argue over whether Wall Street is good or bad, and you can argue over whether the goal of just simply looking out for your shareholders as opposed to the betterment of society is a good thing. But it does make you really predictable. So you can look at what a investor is going to do and really kind of understand where their logic is coming from, and whether you like it or not, that's what you can expect from them. But when you're dealing with governments, particularly governments that can be belligerent to us, whether it's China or Saudi Arabia or any of the Middle Eastern countries, you could see the potential. You're already seeing it happen where you have interests that run completely counter to what we want, and they're being sort of crammed down our throat. So when you have a country like China, say, have control over the purse strings, then it's very hard for somebody like our Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to go to them and say, hey, look, we want you to make sure that, you don't get involved in these disputes in the South China Sea. And they'll say, stick it, Hillary. And the same kind of thing with, like, hey, look, we'd really like you to get on board with this whole Iran thing. And they have their own preconditions. But now they're starting to put up protectionist signs where they won't let companies, that car companies specifically, that want access to their growing market to come in unless they hand over their fuel cell technology, because they want to be able to build the next electric car. And that's completely anti-competitive, but there isn't much we can do about it. You saw the Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner before Congress last week talking about how China is manipulating its currency. We can talk about these things, but there isn't much that we can force them to do on our own. Because have you ever tried to argue with your mortgage banker? You don't get very far. So that is really the danger and the crux of the issue, which is that we, by ceding for various reasons, this economic power, have basically conferred a tremendous amount of geopolitical power on countries that never really had it before. And we don't know what the outcome of this is going to be. What I do know and what I do see is that we're trying to solve the problems of yesterday. We're trying to solve the last crash. And many of the ideas that have come forward, particularly the idea of raising banks, reserve requirements and things like that, are great ideas and will work. But they'll work in preventing what happened before. And I'm afraid that everybody in our country, whether it's Congress, whether it's the administration, whether it's just the average voter, is not focusing on what's next. You mentioned earlier my previous book was What Goes Up, which is an oral history of Wall Street. And in that book, I basically went through all the bubbles from 29 forward. And they have similar characteristics. They all do. But they all look differently when they happen. So the point is that we're never going to be able to solve the next problem until we see the next problem. And I'm pointing to the next problem and saying, here it is, and we better get a handle on this before 10 years are up and it's too late.
Okay, I appreciate that overview. For the average person, they could never imagine that the Pentagon has run elaborate simulations of global financial war. The results, the shadow market, countries won, the United States lost. Take us through the idea that the enormous banks, the United States, Europe, and Japan today must bow and scrape before the larger capital reserves of the shadow market countries, and how that also means that what we might be able to say as far as offshoring of our jobs to these countries, them putting their currency more in alignment with what it should be, to be fair, having at least some sense of parity, so that American workers are not always the ones being victimized. None of this really matters as long as we are beholden to these shadow powerful people to keep paying all of our bills. I don't think the average American realizes how codependent we are on China, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, United Emirates, and other countries to pay for our bills. Your thoughts, please.
The economic war games that you alluded to really is the where you want to look in terms of how we play the world and how the world plays us. This is really where sort of the rubber hits the road and why jobs are offshored and why we haven't figured out exactly what to do. And it goes all the way to the top because of our lack of understanding of what happens and what's going to happen. What happened was about a year ago in 2009, the spring of 2009, Pentagon, for the first time ever, held what they called an economic war game, which basically was like a normal, you know, like the movie War Games. It was described to me as they went into a room and it was very like Dr. Strangelove, you know, the movie. And they've got in there hedge fund traders, they've got Wall Street executives, they've got economists, they've got academics, and they divide them up into teams. You're the U.S., you're China, you're the Middle East, blah, blah, blah. And you're Europe. And they have proctors up front, and they say, okay, here's your scenario. Now what's going to happen? And the scenarios are things like North Korea's got a nuclear bomb, you know, and is going to use it. You know, Israel-Palestine it blows up, and, you know, we've got to deal with it. And basically what would happen, as all these things would play out, and then there would be economic issues too, you know, devaluation of the dollar, whatever else. And as these situations played out, what went on was we lost every single time because we would get involved in various different wide-ranging problems and not really focus on what's going on. China and the other countries that are in the shadow market did focus on what they needed to do, which was to gather money, gather strength, and they beat us by us losing sight of what was important and what we could do. And instead of behaving, instead of behaving in our best interest, we behaved as if we had to show the world that we were a superpower. We had to prove that over and over and over again. And you see it in the real world in what we did in Iraq and things like that, where we, you know, very expensive boondoggles that are going to cost us for a long, long time. And so basically the guys who there, you have CIA and other national intelligence people walking around the room in utter amazement at what went on. And one of the participants told me, this is all in the book, one of the participants told me that, you know, we just lost sight of what the hell we were doing. And the question is whether we ever knew what we were doing. And that's really what's frightening to me, because all China had to do to get us to do what it wanted to do was move like the maturity of its debt from 30 days to 90 days, or sell just a trickle of its assets of ours. And this would cause total economic chaos here and mean absolutely nothing there, because they're playing with their savings and we're playing with our real economy. So when, if they dribble out a little of their savings or are willing to take a little bit of a loss for a geopolitical purpose, it doesn't even affect their economy, because they're playing with, in effect, they're like 401k. We are dealing with our real economy, and this causes a major disruption here. People get very upset, and suddenly the administration in power is forced to give in to the other power that's doing this, largely because we've overextended ourselves in other areas.
I appreciate you sharing these thoughts with us. You're bringing us into a position of better understanding those individuals and institutions that are simply beyond reproach at this time. They virtually can do what they want to do with impunity, and that's unfortunate. A closing thought on what we as Americans can do to help change this, or can we?
Well, I do think we can. First of all, we have to recognize what we have, which is we have the most desirable economy still. In terms of diversity, our industrial base is there's no country in the world that has our industrial base, Silicon Valley, I'm just going to tip them off the top of my head, Hollywood, Wall Street, where the financial world still has to flow through. I mean, these are major, major, major industries, and I've skipped a bunch, that are based here. So we have this expertise, and we have people who would want to be a part of this. What we have to do is allow them in. We can't put up barriers to other countries investing. And we have to create policies where our companies can go out and, instead of shipping jobs overseas, go build operations overseas and take American workers with them. We have to view, in effect, the world, whether you're an investor, whether you're a worker, whether you're a company, whether you're a government, you have to view the world as our market, as opposed to our country being our market, and then we'll worry about the rest of the world when it comes later. We have to engage much, much more. In addition, our government needs to, first of all, get its fiscal house in order. Nobody says get rid of the debt, but at least bring it down to a ratio of their gross domestic product that's reasonable. The benchmark is 30%, but, you know, better economists can argue over that. But basically get our debt in line. And then beyond that, start building alliances to check this thing. It's very hard for the United States alone to wrap its arms around what I just described. I mean, any country alone is not going to be able to do it. So we need to create alliances with other Western countries, with India, with countries with like minds that would want to keep an eye on the power that's being displayed by other countries, and build some sort of global solution, of smart regulatory structure that keeps this in check. You're never going to go to China and say, hey, look, open your books, and they're going to go, oh, cool, here you go, you know, take a look. But what we can do is force trade rules, global trade rules that benefit us all. And for a long time, we've only been focused on what's best for the United States. And we really need to look at how to create partnerships with the rest of the world, recognizing that there's this other thing out there that wants to eat us whole. And if we can do that, I think we, you know, it doesn't have to be a, you know, Hitchcock horror story. It just is something that we have to deal with. My concern is that I don't think we're dealing with it.
I would agree. Thank you very much, Eric, for being with us today. All the best with your new work, The Shadow Market.
Thanks so much, Gary.
A group of wealthy nations and powerful investors secretly dominate the world.
Thanks so much, Gary. I really enjoyed talking to you.
All the best to you.
Okay.
We're out of time. Our next program here on the Progressive Radio Network is Dr. Stephen Barnett in Paradise Parking Lot. And you can read the article, original investigative reporting article on eugenics through vaccination by the Gates Foundation, on GaryNoll.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Have a nice day, everyone.
In our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.